Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll hear about efforts underway to revitalize once troubled neighborhoods in Dayton and a preview of WISO's New Year's Day special honoring the Dayton Literary Peace Prize ceremony held earlier this year. Up first in the news wrap, disagreements with neighbors or spouses can be ugly and they can also be costly. That's where the Dayton Mediation Center comes in. As WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, mediation can mean savings for governments and participants.
Have you ever been hopping mad at your next-door neighbor? You're not alone, says Michelle Zaremba, the director of the Dayton Mediation Center.
One woman, this was about a year ago, she called and she said, "I'm a very violent person and I need help right now."
The people next door were being rowdy and this woman had had it. But she was trying to get her own life together and she really didn't want it to escalate. The Mediation Center contacted the neighbors and helped broker a peace accord of sorts, which is exactly the idea. Volunteer mediators can save money for the city by taking cases that might otherwise go through police or the courts. Zaremba says the recession also created more of a need for mediation because people had less money, even in wealthier areas.
They weren't able to afford an attorney to go through different processes, or they had to stay in their neighborhoods and they couldn't just up and leave. So they needed another option.
And make no mistake, Zaremba says,
not everybody leaves here holding hands and singing kumbaya.
But it can be a cheaper way to get the job done and potentially to get your neighbor off your lawn before you blow your lid. For WISO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
The Dayton Mediation Center also has another cause, small businesses. As Kijin Higashibaba reports, a two-year-old mediation program helps community members and local businesses resolve issues before they escalate.
The People's Market on the west side of Dayton is one of the only grocery stores around. The owner, Biftia Hussein, stands at the door to greet customers as they come in.
Hey, how are you? Pretty good.
About a year ago, Hussein got a letter from the Dayton Mediation Center.
Basically, they told me we have troubles with your store.
Someone he had banned from the store had complained about it at a community meeting. Hussein agreed to sit down with some leaders from the local priority board.
When a person is barred from the store, it's my responsibility. It's nobody else's responsibility.
He never actually found out who complained, but with the help of the Dayton Mediation Center, the leaders talked to both parties and de-escalated the situation. Hussein has been to mediation a few times since, not for complaints against him. He goes to speak for immigrant business owners who he says may become targets.
Most of those convenient-type stores in the area are owned by either Middle Eastern people or Indian and Pakistani people. And most of these people are not represented anywhere. When I hear somebody, for example, blindly attacking those foreigners taking over and not, wait, hold it. So I have to defend that situation.
He says he appreciates that opportunity for give and take with the community. The Dayton Mediation Center offers mediation between business owners and their neighbors throughout the city. For WISO, I'm Kijin Higashibaba.
Up next in the news wrap, Wittenberg geology students and the city of Springfield have paired up to reduce pollution in area rivers and streams. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that the partnership is expected to save the city money and serve as a learning experience for students.
Buck Creek cuts through the middle of Springfield. Trees line the banks, and in the warmer months, kayaking and other activities are common recreation. But there's a problem. During heavy rains, the sewage system gets overwhelmed.
So we get overflows of that untreated sewage and stormwater into Buck Creek. And as you can imagine, that's a big water quality nightmare.
Sky Shelley is the stormwater coordinator for Springfield. He says that's why the city has partnered with Wittenberg to create rain gardens. A rain garden has plants with deep roots that soak up water, which will help get rid of pollutants. What's more, he says, the city can turn vacant lots into these rain gardens.
So there's right now, you know, hundreds and hundreds of vacant lots in Springfield, and these need to be repurposed somehow. And what we're proposing to do is repurpose this to collect and store stormwater.
Shelley says the project could save Springfield millions of dollars in waste management costs. Wittenberg geology professor Sarah Fortner says her students are gaining hands-on experience and that the work could have an impact beyond Clark County.
So it's part of a larger problem that's going on nationally, too, and so exploring these sort of community-scale projects is really a good way to solve the problem locally, but then also think about how you can expand that into other communities.
Fortner is seeking funding to continue and expand their environmental work. Meanwhile, Springfield will have a consultant look at improving its current sewage system. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Since the late 70s, neighborhoods surrounding Salem Avenue have been in decline. The reasons vary and include foreclosures, the loss of businesses and residents, and rising crime. Now an effort is underway to revitalize neighborhoods like Five Oaks, Grafton Hill, and Mount Vernon. Businesses, residents, and city officials are teaming up to rebrand the area. Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal says the area has been officially designated as the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor.
Well, actually, it's a revitalization effort for Salem Avenue, which is one of the key corridors leading into downtown Dayton. And much about how people view communities in terms of whether they're welcoming and whether they're safe is what they see along the main corridors. So there is a concentrated effort by a number of stakeholders, including SAVA, Salem Avenue Business Association, and others, and also through the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor, which is his own nonprofit entity, to work to revitalize the Salem Avenue corridor.
And so give me some of the reasons that revitalization is necessary down that corridor and probably some other corridors in Dayton as well.
Well, you know, actually, I would say all the corridors, they need to be welcoming in terms of inviting people to not only come into the community, but spend time in the community. So people will form an impression about the vitality of a community, its safety, how welcoming it is by what they see. And there's also something to be said in how we describe places. So, the Peace Corridor says something about, at least for that particular major thoroughfare, a statement about the kind of community that we all aspire to live in, which is a community of peace.
And are you getting buy-in from businesses along the corridor and from people in the neighborhoods surrounding?
Yes, actually, there was a bus tour of a number of the neighborhoods that are accessible through Salem Avenue. That was occurred Sunday also. And there were, neighborhood residents, there were, business owners. So it was really a mixed group who were part of this tour and are also part of this effort. All have an interest in seeing Salem Avenue and its adjoining neighborhoods and surrounding area to become a vibrant, I'll say a more vibrant area of the Dayton community. And has this, beautiful, first of all, just the architecture that's there is rather incredible, to say the least, but it has this incredible history, too, all these communities and neighborhoods. So there's a rich history here, but, Dayton has been hard hit as an urban center through blight and deindustrialization and the dwindling economy. So there is challenges here in the community for, how do we establish a new identity and a new sense of life and vibrancy. And so it's going to really take the input of citizens and, business association and governmental leaders all working together with a common vision. And so the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor is a catalyzing effort to create that vision for places that are safe, secure, prosperous, and where there's quality of life.
You mentioned safety, but what is an accurate picture? Assess the situation for me now.
Well, we've had a remarkable few years, to be quite honest, and it was kind of amazing. We, the police department, went through a restructuring in 2011, and went from 5 police districts, 3 patrol divisions. We decentralized investigations, did a number of other things to improve the effectiveness of policing in our community. And that, including a number of efforts from citizens, all that working together, we had the largest decline in violent crime in the city of Dayton compared to the prior 10 years. So a 16% decline in Part 1 violent crime, which is the big stuff, murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. This year to date, we have a 12% decline. So those are large declines. I mean, it's rare to see double digits declines in Part 1 violent crime. It is particularly or even more rare, I would say, to see that 2 out of the past 3 years. So, and most of the decline in 2011 in violent crime was in West Dayton, so it was the greatest beneficiary of improved safety. So a lot of good news here. Now, with that said, there are areas that are still a challenge for us. And even in areas where there is a greater concentration in crime, there's many areas within those smaller areas that have no crime at all. So we know from, looking at the crime throughout many, many years in policing that it is often concentrated in very small places in terms of geography. And so it's really working, trying to understand what's happening in those particular places and not have what happens there, not only to improve that, but not what happens in those concentrated areas of crime, not how that somehow be perceived as how the entire community is.
What do you attribute the declines in crime to?
Well, I'm going to put a little plug in there for some professional policing. Yes, we've worked very, very hard to be much more strategic in how we deliver police services and much more effective in how we deliver those. But ultimately, the safety of a community is defined by the people who live in it. When people are willing to take ownership and be co-producers of public safety, when they're willing to accept their civic duty of being responsible for public safety and work with police to achieve that, great things happen. So where we have had community support and community partnership, that has helped accelerate our advances in reducing crime and disorder.
Tell me a little bit about how important this effort is, Community of Peace and Peace Corridor. Tell me how important it is for businesses along there and the surrounding neighborhoods.
Well, I would say that Salem Avenue, and as well as many other areas of the city, really has needed a vision, right? A vision of a more vital future. And that doesn't come about by accident, right? It doesn't. It requires intentionality. And that was a great word that was used by Atreva Jenkins, who's one of the driving forces in this effort, but this sense of intentionality. So citizens who live and who work and who access these communities have to come together and have to intentionally create the future that they're seeking. And that's really what this effort is about, creating that intentionality.
In your position on the advisory committee, tell me a little bit about how that committee is guiding the core founders of this corridor effort.
Let me just say from a public safety standpoint, that's a little bit more my focus as it relates to being on the advisory committee. And I provide a lot of data and input about areas in the community that had some challenges, or as well as areas that had no crime at all. And so understanding first what's going on in the community, but ultimately, in policing, we focus way too much on who commits crime. The distant second will concentrate on citizens who may be vulnerable to crime and then educate them so they don't create crime opportunities through unthoughtful action. But rarely is ever considered is the role of place, and the role of place is critical. So the fact that the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor, not only in the naming is saying something about the intentionality of the kind of community that everyone is seeking to create, but the fact that they are focusing on physical space, how it is utilized, how it is designed, how it is structured, how it is a part of a larger plan for urban development and, you know, community development, is really crucial to creating the kind of community that we all want to live in.
Any final comments about the corridor efforts and what it's going to take? What are the biggest challenges right now?
Yeah, I think certainly economic investment is going to be important in both private and public sector. I think basically having a vision and continue to develop that vision and implement it sequentially and as elements become available, you know, getting things done on the ground is going to be important. So continuing partnerships certainly with the Dayton Police in terms of having a plan for overall safety for the corridor is important. So all of those need to be worked on.
Sir, I appreciate it. Really, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal. The linchpin of the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor project is a Community of Peace Garden, which will improve the quality of life in the area and its prospects for business even more. Currently, organizers are conducting a feasibility study to determine the best location for the gardens.
Hi, I'm Erin Hopkins on board USS Harry S. Truman. I'm currently deployed. I'd like to wish my family and friends back home in Dayton, Ohio, a happy holidays, and I love you.
This is Lieutenant Colonel Shane Hupp. I'd like to wish my family back in Ohio a Merry Christmas, Eileen, Abby, Ryan, and Audrey.
This is Lieutenant Colonel Darwin Haymeyer from Camp Eggers, Kabul, Afghanistan. I'd like to wish my wife, Christina, and my kids, Abby, Alex, and Austin, back in Beaver Creek, Ohio, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Captain Neil Ocampo at Joint Task Force Bravo here at Sotocano Air Base, Honduras. Can't wait to see everybody in Dayton, Ohio. Sending a shout out to the family and friends, and I hope to see you during the holidays.
Hi, I'm Tech Sergeant Tisha Martin, and I'm stationed out of Dover Air Force Base, Delaware, and I'm deployed here to Camp Bastion, Afghanistan. I'd like to wish my family in Fairborn, Ohio, and Tuttle, Oklahoma, a very happy holidays.
Hey, I'm Second Lieutenant Jamar Meadows from 5 Meadowlawn. I'd like to wish a happy holiday, happy anniversary, happy birthday to my girlfriend Charlotte Gray in Beaver Creek, Ohio. Love you and I miss you.
Hi, my name is First Sergeant Renata Clark, stationed in Fort Wainwright, Alaska. This is my daughter Sierra and my son Isaiah. Wishing our family and friends in Dayton, Ohio, especially Annie Tate, my granny, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hi, my name is Specialist Bruce Ferguson. I'm in 317th SMC in Baumhorn, Germany. My hometown is Fairborn, Ohio. I'm here wishing you and my family a happy holiday.
This is PFC Style from Camp Humphrey, South Korea, giving a happy holidays and Merry Christmas to family back home in Springfield, Ohio. I miss you guys and can't wait to see you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. On New Year's Day, in an hour-long special, WYSO will present speeches from the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Award Ceremony. We'll broadcast the special at noon and 8 p.m. Today, we have a preview of that special with a speech from Adam Johnson. He's the author of The Orphan Master's Son, which won the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction. It's the life story of a young man living in North Korea during the Kim regime. Johnson begins by talking about some of the real-life stories that inspired his novel.
It was almost 10 years ago that I read the story of Kang Chol-won, a man who was interned for 9 years in Camp 15, which is a labor gulag in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The way that North Korea transfers terror from the regime to the individual is through the family. When one person commits or is perceived to commit a crime against the state, the whole family goes to one of these camps, places for which there are no trials or sentences because that's it. 50,000 people toil in Yodok, which is Camp 15, and there's another 50,000 or so in Camp 1418, a sister gulag. And these places are real. It's morning right now on the other side of the world, and all of these people are waking to go into the timber fields and down into the mines. Reading Kang's life was disorienting and very defamiliarizing for me, an average person living my average life in America. What was this strange place, North Korea, I wondered, and what did I know of it? I had heard that the famine struck in the 90s. I'd heard of that. I knew there were some big bombs in North Korea. I'd seen the marionette of Kim Jong-il sing "I'm So Ronery" on Team America World Police, which is a portrait not too far from the one I had in my mind of Kim Jong-il, a man with bouffant hair and elevator shoes and jumpsuits, and who was famous for shooting holes in one, right, at North Korea's lone golf course on Yanggak Island. I had seen videos of North Korean children trained to robotically sing and dance while proclaiming that they lived in the greatest nation on earth, a worker's paradise with universal health care and total happiness. Portraits of evil, absurdity, buffoonery, insanity, that was all I had received of the American media with regard to an entire country and its people. But then I read Kang's memoir. Kang never did learn who in his family had fallen afoul of the state. It was perhaps an uncle, but his entire family was sent away. Kang was only 9 when this happened. He was too young to understand what a labor camp was, which is why he insisted on bringing his beloved fish with him. And this portrait of a boy entering perhaps the worst gulag on earth with his aquarium was really the first human look I'd had at North Korea. And I had a little boy, and I just started to care. And I think it's funny how easy it is to not care about other human beings. We know what's going on in the DR Congo and Sudan and Somalia and many places in the world. We know the hardships that people are facing when we drive past a prison or a hospital, or an impoverished neighborhood. Yet, it's not until we actually know the struggles of an individual that we become invested. And the way we do that is through narrative. We can shake our heads at the fate of a nation, but the story of a boy can kind of just change your course a little bit. Kang's story got me reading more, and I quickly devoured a ream of books about North Korea. I realized I didn't know much about Korean history or culture, or about the Korean War, a dark chapter in our nation's history that, beyond a television show, we as a people have not really confronted. Most of the books I read about North Korea focused on economics and politics and military issues, and very few were just about people. And then I discovered that the stories of average North Koreans, the ones I was hungering for, weren't in books. They were online. They were being gathered by aid workers and missionaries who were assisting defectors out of the northern border across the Yalu and Tumen rivers. Here were the personal narratives of average North Koreans, stories of long hours at sewing machines and self-criticism sessions and guard duty in the cornfields and rabbit breeding on the roofs and stories of living in housing blocks. Here were stories of the arduous march, as the famine was known to them. Stories like these weigh more than you would think. When they're placed in your hands, they're like stones that you have to carry around. And I wonder, where is the point at which, after you've begun the care, that you start to act? I'll never forget the story that did this to me. It was the story of a young woman discovering suddenly that she was starving. Which sounds strange to me. It was a very strange story to come across. She lived in North Hamgyong province, and her family was foraging the hills for food, which was a normal daily activity for them. They hunted wild yarrow and ginger. She was with her parents and two uncles when the five of them found a rotting pear on the ground, and they gathered around as the father cut it into four slices. And then he apologized to his daughter that there was not a slice for her. And that's when it struck her that this wasn't hunger, that this was starving. She asked him point blank, "Are we starving?" And he denied it. And she suddenly realized how foolish she'd been, how naive to think that other people were starving, but not her family and not her. And she said she became very angry with him. "Admit it," she said. "Admit that we're starving," she told him. And even though this is an experience as farther than anything I had ever experienced, I felt like I was right there. And this story was like one of those heavy stones that you have to carry around. And as a writer, there's only one way to unburden yourself of stories like this, and that's to try telling them. And I tell my students that the odds are quite low that a person who has an important story to tell will also have the abilities to tell it. That means people who happen to have a gift for storytelling also have a duty to tell the stories of others who, for whatever reason, cannot tell their own. And I wondered then if I couldn't take all the real stories I'd come across and fashion them into that portrait I'd been looking for of a normal person from North Korea, an average citizen from the lowest of stations. And just the notion of this plagued me with doubt. Who was I to write this story? That was a question I asked myself every single day for 6 years. I wasn't Korean. I had never been to Korea. I didn't speak Korean. I'd never known hunger or war or an intense physical pain. And when I tried to starve myself to see what hunger was like and not eat for a couple days, which is a big deal for me, it wasn't real because I knew I could eat whenever I wanted, you know. These doubts never went away. But I knew from my research that North Koreans were not allowed to tell their own stories. In fact, we don't have evidence of a single unauthorized play or poem or book making it out of North Korea in 60 years and three generations. Even in the worst days of the Soviet gulags, writers risked their lives to create works that responded to the darkness and absurdity around them. Solzhenitsyn wrote in the gulags and had his book smuggled out. There may be an artistic underground in North Korea, but we have no evidence of it. This means that no North Korean has read a novel as you would think of it. A book that explores the human condition, that speaks back, that holds a mirror to society. In fact, after the Japanese occupied the peninsula in 1910, they made Korean literature and music and art illegal. All the Koreans were taught Japanese and given Japanese names. And then after that 35-year period in which their own culture was stolen from them, then came World War II, partitioned by the superpowers, the Korean War, and in the North, 60 years of a Stalinist dictatorship. So for those people, they've been separated from their own cultural tradition for a century. But what of those who make it out of North Korea? They too face great challenges in telling their stories. These are people who have been taught their entire lives not to express their inner thoughts. They're traumatized by their escapes. And because their freedom comes at the expense of those who are left behind, they suffer survivor's guilt. And it may be another generation before they recover their narratives. If it's true that we find it hard to care about others without the personalizing immediacy of their stories, how do we approach an entire people who've been silenced? I do believe that writing outside one's own experience is to trespass in the lives of others. Writing across racial, cultural lines, things like that, come with great risk. But I still ask myself, who am I to write about the lives of people so far away from me? I started asking this other question, though, that stands beside it, which is, why aren't more writers trying to lend their voices to such a people who have been so silenced? Right now, it seems to me it's only through the imaginative reach of narrative that one can vault these borders of the Kim dynasty. And it's only through narrative that we can restore the humanity of a people who are all too often reduced to abstractions and caricatures in our popular culture. I think my book was maybe one of the first books in our society to attempt to do this. And perhaps one day we'll look back and say, oh, what was Johnson thinking? Or Johnson got it all wrong. And I hope if that happens, it comes from a place in which many people have attempted to give voice to those who have lost it, and that hopefully, most importantly, North Koreans are free enough to tell their own stories. And that's the story I'm looking for anyway. And I hope that day comes soon. Thank you.
Adam Johnson, author of The Orphan Master's Son, and winner of the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction. To hear more speeches from the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Awards ceremony, tune into an hour-long special on New Year's Day at noon and 8 p.m. on 91.3 WYSO.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third and the final week of early winter. Shyly, Carol admitted her anguish to me about the moon. I'm so embarrassed, she said. You know, I always thought the moon made its own light, and that, well, it shone from the inside. Then she told me how she had just read that the lunar surface actually reflected light from the sun. We talked only for a few minutes, but I was struck by her emotion and by her need to share her very real disillusion. Her disappointment was especially touching to me because I'd been thinking about how the authority of astronomers and physicists and naturalists is often intimidating, and how most of what we believe about the universe is based on complex technology and mathematics and is quite understandably taken on faith. The result, it seems to me, is that people are becoming more hesitant to think for themselves about what they see around them. They defer to specialists, like peasants to priests, and they lose their wonder and curiosity. And I wanted to reassure Carol and to reassure myself. There are too many lessons to be learned from the concept of a moon that produces its own light. Too many to dismiss the idea as childish or naive. Natural science is only an adjunct to our imagination. The fruit of knowledge does not dangle from a quantifiable tree, but rather hides in our imperfect vision. We will not see God another way. And we live as you assumed, Carol, in the glow of a benign, accessible, self-sufficient moon. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of deep winter. In the meantime, watch the last moon of 2013 wane through its final quarters, making way for the first moon of the new year, the tufted titmouse moon.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Coming up next, The Book Nook.